Now, when one talks about the biological basis of cultural diversity, we could look at it from two points of view, from a sheerly historical one, and the extent to which we can turn to the biological nature of man as an explanation of why we are so different from other people, why Americans are like Americans as compared with the English or the Dutch or the French or the Chinese. What are the possible biological origins of differences in the past, which are of interest to us because they're our own past? That's one way we could look at it. Or we can look at it in a more, from a more practical point of view, in terms of the future. That is, to what extent can we hope that we can look to the biological nature of man for cultural diversity in the future? And not only diversity, of course, but for new inventions. That is, can we hope that there's anything inherent in the human race that will make it possible for it to think up better things than it's thought up so far, or develop human societies that are superior to the ones that it's developed in the past? Now, I suppose the first thing I have to make very clear is that by the biological basis of cultural diversity, I do not mean race. As far as we know, race has contributed nothing to cultural diversity, although the peculiar ideas that some people have about race has contributed quite a little. And so that, in a way, I suppose you could say it's contributed. That is, if there were not striking physical differences between different parts of the human race who have been segregated long enough to develop special physical characteristics that were reasonably stable, so that in some parts of the world you can find a race that can be appropriately described as yellow, and other parts a race that could be appropriately described as red or copper color would have been better. Other places a race that might be described as black or brown, and in Europe and part of North and South America, a race that is usually called, and most erroneously called, white. But of course, pink would be a better term. Now, those physical differences have given rise to a considerable amount of cultural diversity. The sense of superiority that some people's skin gives them has made it possible for them to, when they met people with a different skin color, to establish caste systems and class systems, and systems of slavery and exploitation of various sorts, and that in turn has being the groundwork for different kinds of social orders. So you could, in a sense, say it was a biological basis, but only because of our peculiar capacity to embroider on it. Perhaps I can dramatize it a little more sharply by discussing something that used to happen in Bali. The Balinese Rajas were very fond of girls with a pale yellow skin. And some Balinese, they're a Malay people, it's a branch of the Mongoloid race, some of them had paler yellow skins than others. The ones, however, who had the palest yellow skins were lepers. And that added a considerable element of excitement to the picking out of desirable young girls for the Raja's harem. And it's not surprising that the word leprosy was the worst curse that you could utter in Bali. It was the thing that frightened people most. At the same time, the Rajas, of course, went on looking for young girls with beautiful pale yellow skins. So that you have a kind of embroidery in every part of the world on the question of differences in skin color, differences in physique. In Samoa, occasionally, the girls were born who were honey-colored. Most Samoans are about the color of coffee with a fair amount of cream in it. But once in a while, a girl was born who was really completely honey-colored. Her skin and her hair, this lovely honey-colored hair, and everybody valued that very highly, and a man who had a daughter like that just grew her hair, and then it was cut for a wig for somebody, and he grew it again, and it was cut for a wig for somebody. They were very profitable. And almost all the high chief's headdresses were made of the hair of these particular sorts of girls. And we apparently have a pretty deep-seated human psychological tendency to identify light and white with goodness. That is probably exceedingly deep in the human race. We don't know whether it's in the whole human race. There are those people that can't wake up in the morning and who may be descended from creatures that naturally lived at night. And whether... whether they really think that light is superior to darkness, nobody knows. But they go along with the majority and don't admit it for most of the time. And in every people that we know anything about, brown people in the middle of the Pacific who had never seen a white, quotes, pink person in their lives, nevertheless identified the lighter skin, the lighter hair color with some kind of special virtue. And, you know, we talk about dark deeds and black spots and black evil. Evil's always black. There's no language that we know of in which evil is white, except when ghosts get mixed up with it, but that's secondary. So that there is a possibility that we have a fairly deep-seated psychological tendency that's tied in with the sun, with the fact you can't see what's happening at night, with the fact that night is when you sleep, reinforced by ideas of dirt, which we also have to consider rather late in arriving in human history. But nevertheless, there may be a biological basis for this preference for the light as over against the dark, which underlies our tendency to embroider on racial differences. Now, I don't want to talk about racial differences principally. I really wanted to get this topic out of the way, that racial differences are only a basis for diversity when they are embroidered upon by society. And as far as we know, there are no racial differences of any social or psychological significance whatsoever. Now, that does not mean there are none. It doesn't mean that with better tools or a different set of concepts, we may not someday find some sorts of racial differences. But it does mean that we've never been able to find any yet, and that all the things that we're talking about to date, that people talk about that they think are racial differences, there is no scientific basis for whatsoever. When one talks about the biological basis for racial diversity, we're talking about something rather different. That is, what are the inherent potentialities of human beings, all human beings? What are the differences among them, not as between races, but within any human group of any size, which is itself productive of difference, stimulating to the imagination a possible starting point for different sorts of division of labor, for different complementary relationships between the sexes, for different types of character structure, which one civilization can elaborate and another can disallow. Now, one of our best figures of speech for thinking about this is language. A human baby can make all the sounds that are made in any human language, and many of them do. They're the type of baby we call babblers. And if you listen to them as they talk, they're the kind of baby that make a speech, you know, and you hear, it sounds exactly as if a senator was speaking, only there isn't a single recognizable word, but it's perfectly clear they're talking about something. And if you listen, you will find, and a linguist can distinguish in their speech, not only the sounds that we use in English, but sounds that are used in every other language. And then, suddenly, just before they begin to talk, you find those sounds narrow down. And they usually narrow initially to a paired set of sounds, which are basic to the discriminations of the language they're going to talk. So you get mum 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 da 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 da, or you get mum 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 pa 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 pa, or ba 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 ba. But a pair of sounds, which usually then get applied to the father and mother, naturally enough, with the set of idea of the complementariness between the sexes and the basic complementary sounds. And from that dichotomizing which takes place, and suddenly this rich babble that went on that was preparing them to speak everything from Hottentot to Eskimo to Chinese to Russian suddenly gets narrowed down into the sound pattern of English, if they are American-speaking babies. And from that, they then build up the series of sounds which are discriminatable in English by English-speaking throats and English-speaking ears, English-hearing ears. And but those infants could have spoken any other human language. We have no human language that is not speakable, learnable, understandable by any other human being. And furthermore, every human language has to cover the range, the normal range of capacity to pronounce and capacity to discriminate. Of course, it doesn't have to include the deaf, and it doesn't have to include lispers. Although a language that was particularly susceptible to arousing lispers would probably have to modify itself in time if it had too many people lisping in it. And there is something extraordinary about the disappearance of the lisp that we don't know much about. But if you notice, there are very few people that lisp anymore, and there used to be a great many who did. So presumably something has happened to America that makes it a little easier for lispers, but nobody knows what that is. However, every human language has to be speakable by all types of human beings, and to include their auditory and pronouncing capacities. However, and every culture that we know anything about in the same way has to be livable by most human beings, however different they are to start with. But and there's a limit to the range of difference that you can have if you build a culture that fits too sharply to one type of person and disallows too many others. You then have a source of discord within it that is likely to make it break down. Now, we can discriminate three sorts of differences between individuals which are given play between languages. I mean, some languages are more congenial to some minds than others. Some cultures are considerably more congenial to some kinds of people than others. And beginning about 25 years ago, anthropologists began to speculate on the possibilities that the differences between cultures were due to a given culture institutionalizing one type of personality rather than another, progressively emphasizing through time the preferences that were more congenial to one temperament than another. Now, I'm going to use the word temperament here to mean innate propensity or tendency that is genetically determined. We wouldn't know how because it's a construct at the moment, but genetically determined and probably with constitutional correlates, but we know too little about constitutional types to do very much with it. And the United States is a particularly poor place to do anything with constitutional differences because we've got such a dreadful amalgam of people. And you may be able to make a study in Swabia, as Kretschmer did, and if you are a practicing physician in Swabia and know something about people, you may be able to tell when a man comes in the door what's likely to be wrong with him. And you may be right. So that you can arrive at the conclusion that a man with a certain degree of overemphasis on the longitudinal is more likely to be a schizophrenic than a manic depressive in the days when those were categories, and in Swabia. And you may arrive, actually, if you are a physician with a long clinical experience in a given area, at exceedingly accurate guesses about what disease types individuals are going to be and so forth in that sort of population. In the United States, however, where we draw on short, stocky people and tall, thin people and tall, bony people and all sorts of people and muddle them all up and marry them to each other, it's almost impossible to do any work on constitutional type that is very meaningful at present. But it's quite probable, in terms of what we know at present, that we will ultimately find that there are relationships between temperament and constitution. They may not turn out to be quite what we think they might be now, but we'll probably find some. But I'm using temperament here without insisting on any visible physical correlates. It may turn out that there is something that is inherited in a difference between people that is not correlated with their physique in any way. And so that if one assumes that within each group that is large enough to have a normal human range, you find the same variations in temperament, then you may ask whether one culture has not institutionalized the choices that are preferable for one temperament and another culture the choices for another. Now, there's another way in which one can look at this, and that is to take the categories that the Freudian psychology has popularized in a great deal of their thinking, the categories that they usually label oral and anal and genital types, or simply to take the distinction between what they call the oral receptive type, those are the people that just like to open their mouths and let things fall in, and the oral sadistic or oral aggressive type are the people that are busy going out and biting what they want to get. Now, Freudian characterology has done a great deal of work in differentiating among these different types as types of behavior which are built up in the life experience of the individual due to the way they are fed, the way they are disciplined, the way they are trained, the way they are put to sleep, and to the general behavior of their parents and nurses and teachers and so forth. And it is possible to take a description, such as the description that the Freudians give, for instance, of the oral receptive type, which is a character which is more interested, has patterned its relationship to the outer world on its original contacts through the mouth. You can have oral pessimists or oral optimists, depending on what happens to you when you're young. But if you're an oral optimist, you on the whole believe that if you open your mouth, somebody will put some food in it. You believe that relationships to food are more interesting than anything else. You're not a very saving person because you believe there's always more where that came from. You are trusting because the major pattern of your life was built up at a period when what you wanted was to have something put in your mouth, and it was. And so you learn to believe that it always will be, so that you have your confident, trusting, optimistic, somewhat dependent because you are looking for other people to put things in your mouth rather than putting it in yourself. You don't take hold of life very hard, but you open your mouth gracefully and expect other people to put things in. Oral receptive people, of course, talk a great deal, too. And all activities that are connected with the mouth tend to be standardized in this sort of character. Now, this is a clinical psychiatric syndrome based on clinical study of certain sorts of personality. But you can also find primitive societies which you can characterize in the same way. I worked with one such society in New Guinea, which could be quite thoroughly characterized as a society that was stylized, in which all the original clues to what kind of personality you were going to be were given through the feeding situation. The one thing that everybody wanted to do was to feed and grow something. Children were fed with a great deal of warmth, and the society was very short of food, so coconuts were tabooed to be fed to nursing mothers and small babies. Women who did all the carrying in the society because their heads were stronger, used to climb up and down steep mountains with loads of 100 pounds suspended from their foreheads in a net bag, with their babies in a sling under their breasts, nursing their babies as they climbed up and down the mountain, so that the baby would not be deprived in any way. The fathers And mothers both kept very onerous taboos so that the child would grow. And marriage was based on, again, an oral tie, which a little girl of about 8 or 9 was betrothed to a boy of about 13 or 14. They hoped. They didn't keep very careful track of time, and they were very poor with figures. They had none of these holding on traits that are associated with other characterological positions. And so that they didn't always keep count of people correctly, and sometimes the girl turned out to grow faster than they hoped. They planned their marriages so that the little girl was about 4 months younger than 4 years younger than the boy, and then the boy grew her. And he went hunting, and he worked sago, and he grew yams, and he grew his wife. And after he'd grown her by feeding her, then she had to be dutiful and obedient to him. Anytime she didn't get dinner quickly, he said, "Who grew you?" And the whole relationship between husbands and wives, between parents and children, was based on food. And people grew, they gave each other their pigs to grow, too, so that one of the things you did for other people was to grow the other people's pigs. And then later you could extend claims to that pig's grandchild because you grew its grandmother. And there was a great deal of discussion on that point. And their whole approach to the physical environment was, again, a pleasantly oral receptive one. They would dig deep traps out in the bush, and then they went home and stayed in the village till they dreamt something had fallen into it. They made very few things themselves, but admired the things that other people made, and then would work quite hard to snare birds with beautiful feathers or to raise some pigs that they could trade for the superior handicraft of other people. And they said they make things better than we do, and we're so glad to have them. It was quite a consistent picture. About 50 miles away, there was another tribe who corresponded to the type of character that the psychoanalyst identifies as oral sadistic. They were people who detested children, taught their babies to eat when they could because they weren't going to get much of a chance at it. Women always nursed their babies standing up and just held them just long enough to keep them from crying and then popped them up on the back of their necks. They hung them up in the Arapesh. My first people hung their babies in a soft net bag against their backs or under their breasts where they hung close to the mother's skin and curled up in a nice soft position. The Mundugamore, the second tribe, put their children in a rough, harsh basket, and then on which if you scratched, it made the noise that your nails make on a blackboard. And when the babies cried, they went and scratched on the outside of the basket. And the babies learned that was always going to happen, so they might as well accept it. And lovemaking among the Mundugamore was conducted more or less like a fight, in which any encounter between lovers, they both came back scarred and battered. And a routine instruction from parents to children was what to say when you came in with your face ripped open. And you said, I was going through the bush and a briar caught me. So, and that was all. I mean, you had to know the right things to say because it was proper. And these were people that when they got angry, as they often did, against, and you can see why, their method of committing suicide was to get into a, they would get so angry they would decide to commit suicide, get even with everybody, and they would get into a canoe and go down the river to the next tribe of cannibals who would eat them. So that you had a consistent emphasis, again, of people uninterested in property, uninterested in time, uninterested in punctuality, uninterested, they got things from other people too, but by acquisition, a big man would marry 10 wives from another tribe and make all his brothers in law give him things. And if they didn't give him things, they raided them and ate them. And so that they had quite a lot of things, but they got them from other places, but not the same way the Arapesh did. Well, these statements have a certain element of caricature in them. These were both societies that had family and social organization and Afanol Exchange and religious systems and all the rest of them, and I'm giving you only the high points of the particular sorts of emphasis that distinguish one from the other, merely to draw attention to the possibility that a given society, and especially a small society, where there are only a few people, a few hundreds or a few thousands of people, it's possible for them to very heavily emphasize one relationship to the world, to emphasize the first period in a baby's life or the second period in a baby's life, and to stress it at the expense of other aspects. Now there's another, and that can be expressed, as the analyst would express it more or less, in terms of zones and modes, so that you can say which zone of the body communication with the outer world becomes the pattern for later development, or you can say which mode becomes the pattern, with the fact that incorporation is the proper mode for the oral zone, retention for the gastrointestinal tract, and intrusion for the genital zone, speaking from a masculine point of view, and or inclusion if you're speaking from a feminine point of view. Now, and that these are modes of communication between the body and the outer world, which can be picked up and elaborated and made the basis of institutions. I probably should have added that another thing that my first people do is that the men would prefer to think that the children were theirs. They are very jealous of the fact that the women produced them. So they have elaborate religious ceremonies in which they feed the novices on a little bit of their blood, and they say they're their children and not the women's children. Again, a feeding operation. Now, but another way, and you can say, you can still carry this back to the question of constitution or temperament, as many psychiatrists do, in saying, all right, it's true that this child had a special kind of feeding situation and was overfed or underfed or something, but also it probably was more interested in eating, or it had more sensitive lips, or it had a different kind of stomach or something from other children, that there may be a constitutional difference. So if the same mother feeding children in the same way may produce an oral pessimist from one child and an oral optimist from another with the same amount of milk. So that they would accept the possibility that there are fair individual differences in innate propensity, which may be the groundwork for character development in individuals in our own society and in these simpler societies, may be picked up institutionally. Now you can look at this another way and consider what happens if a society decides, and I'm using decides anthropomorphically, but of course they don't decide, they through a long period of time come to follow one course of action instead of another. What happens if they emphasize one age in development instead of another? Now, if you look at the maturation of a child, which is, as far as we know, identical in every society, it is the things that are completely innate. The sequential development comes along. Children, as far as we know, are born able to walk and talk. They have to learn it. In every society, there are children who walk before they talk, and there are children who talk before they walk. And although we have these extreme differences in language, so that some languages anybody in this room could learn in 6 weeks, and some languages some people in this room could never learn at all as adults, in all probability, if you'd had a sufficiently gloomy view of language learning taught you by being Americans. But in all of these languages, the ones that are irregular and the ones that are regular, the ones that are filled with what seem to us very difficult sounds and the ones that are filled with very simple ones, all human children learn them with about the same age range. There will be the child that learns to speak early and the child that learns to speak a little later, but we have no indication that there's any genuine difference as between one language and another. And although you may find some sorts of shift, for instance, our children, the sequence of children walking on all fours, standing and squatting will may be reversed from one society to another. So in one case, in one case, the our children may learn to squat much later than Balinese children or something of that sort. But although you get small variations, the general sequence is the same. That human children first, when they're born, their major communication is through the mouth. That later they learn to sit up, and then they learn to creep or crawl unless they're prevented from doing it by their parents. They then learn to walk and talk with various sorts of variations. They then learn to respect property, to obey prohibitions, to go about by themselves. And this general sequence holds in every society and seems to be a property of our biological nature. That is, we can assume that, as far as we know now, that children who are reared without other human beings do not learn to talk, although they would be able to learn to talk. But we still have to assume that the ability to learn to talk develops in human children at about the same range of age in every society. Now, it makes, therefore, a great deal of difference which age people decide to make a fuss about. If they put their principal emphasis on the little baby, and little babies are paid a lot of attention to and are taught and played with and handled with a great deal of discrimination, then you may have a society in which the characteristics of the first 2 years are very highly accentuated and the characteristics of later years are much less accentuated. If you have a society like ours, which is primarily interested in control, autonomy, respect for property, you put an enormous amount of emphasis on the age from 2 to 4, which is our major period of training children. They have to learn to keep clean. They have to learn not to touch things that belong to other people. They have to learn to be able to walk upright, to walk by themselves, to do things by themselves, to value doing things by themselves, to learn to be relatively independent, and that we push them away and push them away and push them away like that. There are other societies that aren't interested in cleanliness and aren't interested in punctuality and aren't interested in motor control, and they don't work on that period so much. My Arapesh people would start a little 2-year-old girl out on a walk, and they'd put a little bag on her head that was like her mother's, but if she got tired, they picked her up and put her in her mother's bag, and her mother carried her. And children would sit on top of a platform and scream for their parents to come and get them, and somebody went and got them. And if they wanted a knife at the age of 2, a big knife that somebody had, and they cried for it, somebody would give it to them, and they'd cut themselves with it, and everybody would be sorry. Now, I worked with one primitive people who were extraordinarily like us in many ways. Although they were an old Stone Age people in the middle of the Pacific, not having yet gotten to the stage of monotheism, and they lived on houses on stilts over the sea, and they had nothing except what their skill and enterprise brought them. They had to trade for all the wood out of which they built their houses. They had to trade for the shingles with which they thatched them. They had to trade for the cord with which they made their fish nets and the wood out of which they made their canoes. And with their fishing, they caught enough fish to trade for other sorts of food and things that they needed from the landspeople. So they were in a position with very limited capital, only their skill, and they owned no land at all, except a few little bits that they'd manufactured and a few little bumps. And otherwise, they lived on houses on stilts in the lagoon. And they were the best fed people in the whole archipelago, and they were they handled all the trade for that part of the Admiralty Islands, and everything had to be carried in Mana's ships. Now, they were a society that were primarily interested in children getting control of themselves, of their bodies, of property. From the minute a child was born, virtually, you started training it not to touch things, to be careful what he was going to do. They never carried a child anywhere in their arms where the mother's arms would be a comfortable rest for the baby. They just let the baby lie on its back until it, and then learn to sit up as soon as possible, and then learn to hang on. And then you put the baby on the back of your neck, and it hung on around your throat. The first time I let a child do that, I thought I'd never speak again. And they had to hang on so hard that if the mother was punting a canoe and her paddle caught, or her punting pole caught, and she pitched over in the water, the baby would not let go, which was an enormous emphasis on control. You see, right away. They taught them to swim as they taught them to walk, so that you learn to swim and walk at the same time, and to climb. And then the minute they were able to handle anything, they were taught to handle big canoes. And you'd see a father sitting still while his tiny son punted him through the village. They never let children take care of them at all. They were taken care of by adults who were perfectly poised, perfectly competent, so the child never encountered anything that wasn't expert. And I experienced that very sharply once by, well, I hadn't been there very long, and I was standing down on one of these little bits of land at low tide, looking up, and the child was up about 10 feet on the house platform, and I looked up like that, and it came hurtling into my arms. Fortunately, I caught it. But the children had no experience of adults that couldn't catch you if you jumped from any height. Now, they were a people who emphasized all the virtues that go with the emphasis on control over one's gastrointestinal processes, over holding on, grasping, not dropping things when you don't want to drop them, looking where you're going, not setting the house on fire, knowing whose property is whose, knowing what time it is. They're the only primitive people I ever worked with who dragged the children home to meals and made them go to bed at night. Most people let children go to bed when they're tired instead of turning into insomnia. But not the moms. They yanked them home at night, shrieking and screaming, and make them go to bed on time. They were fascinated by numbers. They could count up to 400,000 without any form of notation whatsoever. And so they had all the characteristics, the syndrome that go together, an interest in time, property, money, cleanliness, autonomy, control. Now, they were right in the middle of the Pacific and as far removed from our tradition as would be, well, very easy to think of. People, the women had only a couple of grass aprons and the men had a G-string. They had stone tools. They had no written language. None of the things that were part of our tradition. But a character structure that was extraordinarily like ours. And they made excellent engineers. When they went away to work for Europeans, they learned to run a diesel engine in a week. They were only interested in how and nothing else. And I took my typewriter there and they'd stand around it and say, now then she pushes that. That hits that. That pushes on that. Makes a mark on that. What's on that long black strip? They, our place, would say, used to have a black and red ribbon always in the field, and they'd say, oh, make it red, make it red, make it red. Now, one could go on and multiply instances of these sorts, but I don't have time to do that this evening. But we can, if we take these three possibilities, the possibility of taking one temperament, the possibility of taking one basic mode of communication, one bodily relationship to the environment, and of taking one age rather than another in the maturational sequence, we can look over the world at the different cultures that we know and we can say, all right, this is a society where the model is, say, 2 to 4. where the problems that that society wants children to solve first and best are the problems that are that have to be solved by all children to some degree between 2 and 4. We invented schedules, and the baby had to learn that if it weighed so much, it was hungry so often. At birth, mothers in this society don't wait until a child is old enough to understand anything. They start talking to it right away about it. And so it's very interesting to contrast, for instance, the way the English who lay a great deal more emphasis on the first year, first 2 years in training their children, and expect much less during this second 2 year period. Now they teach, if you have a child in England who's banging at you or has a spoonful of jam at the table and starts waving it. The English mother puts up her hand like this, just so the jam doesn't hit. The American mother says, put that spoon down. So that you will find that if a society has selected one age as an age for emphasis, they usually spread it backwards and forwards so that you will have this kind of training for moral autonomy and cleanliness and punctuality started at birth in societies that care a great deal about it, whereas in a society where most of the emphasis is put on the things that a little baby learns, trust and receptivity, that those will be carried on up into a later period. And by making a systematic arrangement of points of this sort, we can see some of the sources of variations between different societies. Once a general, say, oral receptive or very early infancy pattern has been set up, all babies will be treated in this particular way. All women will learn to treat them that way. Some will be better at it than others, but it's got to have enough inclusiveness so everybody can survive in it. And so it will be diluted and informed with other possibilities enough to be a possible vehicle for all the human beings born within it, but nevertheless to have a very sharp emphasis. And then there's one further point that probably ought to be made here, and that's the different ways in which human beings can learn. As far as we know, human beings can learn in a considerable number of ways. They can learn by trial and error. They can learn by Pavlovian conditioning. That is, learning that when there's a bell, there will be the meat powder, and the thing you do is to learn to listen for the bell. That builds up to divination in primitive society. They can learn by what is called technically instrumental avoidance. If you do something and you get an awful electric shot or a bang on the head, so you never do it again, which societies that are based on taboo, with a tremendous emphasis on teaching people to avoid things, use. It's the most non-experimental approach there is, because if you've learned by what's called instrumental reward, is if you do this, you get a reward. Well, then you try something else, see if you get a reward from that. But if most of your learning is, if you venture out there, if you touch that, if you try this, bing, you get punished, the individual withdraws and never tries that again and becomes an exceedingly law-abiding citizen for most of his life. Or you can learn by what's technically called rote, which means that you simply learn long rows of things in order without ever knowing what they mean. If you're interrupted in the middle of the story, you have to go back to the beginning in order to tell it. You can learn by the recognition of pattern. Probably everybody here has been brought up on those chimps and the banana and the two sticks, or haven't you anymore? But the type story that's in elementary psychology is the chimp that, and there's a banana he can't reach, and he has two pieces of bamboo, one will fit into the other. And the chimp doesn't spit at the banana and wave at the banana and do all sorts of trial and error things that all the chimp sits and looks at the banana. And looks at the sticks and looks at the banana and looks at the sticks. Then he takes one stick and he fastens it in the other and he takes the long stick and he knocks the banana down. And that's another form of learning that human beings are also capable of, more than chimps. These are all biological potentialities. And there are societies that depend enormously on rote learning. There are societies that depend enormously on teaching people to analyze a situation and meet a new situation. There are societies that depend on reward and punishment almost completely. And as they depend on one of these forms of learning rather than another, all of them being human potentialities, the shape of the society will alter. And many of your institutions will alter. And whether people are goal-oriented will alter or not. We think that the way to analyze behavior is to ask, what did you do it for? What did you want? What was the goal? And we distinguish a neurotic as a person who's trying to get to a goal by the wrong means and won't get him there. But it never occurs to us there could be people that weren't going anywhere. We know those people occasionally, but we think there's just something wrong with them. But if you think of the people that you know who just like to be, who don't want to go anywhere in particular, who aren't interested in what time it is, who like what they're doing at the moment, fishing is one of the things they like, especially, and or dancing or sitting in the sun, and who have no ulterior motives of any kind, including getting through school or anything of the sort. And there are societies that are organized in just about that way. And I want to conclude by describing when we first went to Bali, which is a combination of instrumental avoidance and rote learning as its major methods of learning, one of the things we wanted to find out was why people made offerings and took them to temples. We were living in a village of about 400, something over 400 people, in which there were 11 temples, and there was a feast in one of them almost every day, for which people made the most elaborate things. They cooked, and they went to market and traded for various kinds of fruit, and they made all sorts of elaborate cut-out designs, and it was about equivalent to trimming a whole Christmas tree every time you made an offering. So the question was, why did they make them? And we tried all the proper techniques that we knew from other societies to figure out why. You make a list of people who took offerings to a given temple on a given day, and then you asked each one of them why they took them, and you asked them why the other ones took them, and you tried to find the people that didn't take them, and absolute blank. Couldn't get any answers that made any sense, and you analyzed a pattern, the pattern didn't make any sense. The people weren't all brothers-in-law, or they weren't all born on Wednesday, or they didn't all live in this corner of town, or nothing that you worked on made any sense at all, which is very frustrating to goal-oriented Americans. But I found after I'd been there about a month, I'd be going down the street and meet a woman. She'd say, taking an offering to the temple this afternoon, Nonya? And I go a little further, and I meet another woman. She said, what are you putting in your offering, Nonya? And I go a little further, another woman would say, putting lemons in yours, Nonya? And I go a little further, and somebody would say, like an unoffered orange to put in your offering, Nonya? And I'd sort of take the orange, and then meet somebody and say, who's carrying your offering, Nonya? And then I go home and say, why aren't we sending an offering to that temple?
Any other questions? If not, there'll be...
There will be some.
She wants them.
Yeah, otherwise I might as well just talk on you have to differentiate it. The question was, what are English aims? What do the English concentrate on? To begin with, they treat children as living in a world of their own. Children in England are regarded more or less as lower, mobile upwards, if one used the... they're treated almost as puppies or as kittens. Are there any reporters here? Don't go away and say, said the English treat their children like animals. Which a reporter once did, and I got out of trouble. But they teach them, they treat them as little creatures with a potentiality for humanity that they will show in increasing degrees later. Not as if they were fully developed little moral beings as much as we do. The child is permitted... now, here again, you have to make a class difference considerably between the upper class, upper and upper middle, and lower class. We know more about the upper and upper middle than we do about the lower class child. But they are permitted a considerable amount of play. They tumble about inside a safe world without the world invading it as much as it does here. The result is that you get this picture of English childhood, which is always summed up in the image of a garden, of the lost garden of childhood that people are always trying to get back to. And a child's world with an enormous emphasis on visual imagery, very vivid visual imagery, which is something that goes with the first year, which we lose by our overlay of insistence upon going and looking at something and holding on to it and carrying it around. So that we substitute motor imagery for the visual imagery that is so such a conspicuous part of English poetry and the whole English view of life. Now, there's a great deal more of it, but I think that's probably all I ought to tackle at this stage in the evening. Yes?
How do you view the idea of cultural determinism as outlined by Leslie White of the University of Michigan?
I don't. The whole problem of determinism or open-ended systems or free will and determinism, of course, is one of those interminable paradoxes that are we have no scientific way of solving. You can say that if you build up a society where people believe that what they do will alter the future, then they will do the sort of things that's determined they will do because they believe that they can do it. And you can always be trapped back into the deterministic position. However, if you think of, there's several different traps in this whole position. There is the emphasis on the economic environment, on the state of technology, and you can believe that successive steps of in invention are determinative, and that a man can only do as much as his technology permits him to do, and that the next step in invention in that technology is also determined, so that we are the inevitable puppets of the state of previous invention, the state of the environment at one time. Now, that's partly dependent upon viewing all of human culture as one system. If you view it as a large series of systems, as it has been historically, impinging on each other, in which the events from one system are accidental from the point of view of another system, then you get a series of fortuitous events occurring between systems which you cannot predetermine. You cannot predetermine, for instance, which European ship would touch on which island in the Pacific. Leslie White would say that state of navigation, it was predetermined that they would make a bad hit, which is true. But it was not predetermined whether a Portuguese ship would find one island, a Spanish ship found another, and it was not predetermined whether when they got there all the men would be out fishing. Though it would make a great difference to the contacts between those two people maybe for 100 years afterwards, whether or not the men were home the day the ship got there. Now, all those, one, if one takes a historical view of culture, one accepts these series of events as fortuitous from the standpoint of each cultural system. And so that you have regularities within the system which are due to the biological basis of humanity and the regularities within our own nature, and the response between those regularities and the environment. But between systems, you have a series of events which have to be treated as accident from the standpoint of the system. Now, that's my own personal position. It is not Leslie White's, as you know.
Would it be possible for us to take over some of these anxiety reduction techniques that the primitives practice?
Can you hear the questions, or do you want me to... Would it be possible for us to take over some of these anxiety reducing techniques that the primitives practice? It isn't really possible for us to take over any technique simply at the level at which it's used. What we can do is to look at these different societies, learn more about the potentialities of human nature, about the relationship between upbringing and character structure, between different forms of institution and different kinds of personality, make high-level abstractions, and from those abstractions, change our own patterns. Now, I think probably the best illustration, perhaps, that we have of that is the kind of infant feeding that we call self-demand feeding. Now, that has, in this country, has three roots. One of them was psychoanalytic psychiatry, where the analysts found that a great number of the patients that came to them had been children that had been overscheduled and over-routinized in childhood. So they began insisting that a greater freedom for the small infant. Does everybody here know what self-demand feeding is? Today, sometimes called relaxed schedules. And self-demand wasn't a very good word either, because it was typical of American demand, which you had the baby sitting up there demanding the food. Now, one of the roots came from psychiatry, therefore, in the observation of clinical cases here. The second root came from Gazelle's work and an observation of normal growth and development and a sense that the child should grow slowly into the culture and that it was our duty as custodians of the society to fit the culture to the child. Gazelle doesn't really think much of adults. And he thinks the real reason that you have a society is for the sake of the children, and we ought to fit it to the child. And as children had different paces and different rhythms, each child's feedings should be fitted to that particular child. And the third route was anthropology, because when we studied primitive children, we found out a great many things about breastfeeding that hadn't been very evident to pediatricians who hadn't seen any for some time. And now those three roots put together were layback of the invention in this country of self-demand feeding. But self-demand feeding is not primitive. It is one of the least primitive things that you could possibly think of doing. It would be inconceivable for a primitive people to have even thought of such a thing. Because self-demand feeding is based on, first, a recognition of individual differences that is very high, that is higher than most societies have ever been able to arrive at. It's based on a clock and a pencil and an ability to write. That is, you look at the baby, you give the baby a chance to eat when it's hungry, and you write down when it ate. And after a little while, the baby sets up a schedule of its own, which is not like the schedule that the doctor sets up. And each baby's schedule is quite idiosyncratic and different. Some babies want to eat every hour for 3 hours and then not eat for 5 hours, which is just fine. I mean, you can go to see Gone with the Wind in that interval. And you put the schedule down, and in about anywhere between 3 and 6 weeks, you have a perfectly good schedule. As the baby has settled down to a rhythm that the mother can follow, but it is not the 10, 2, 6, 10 rhythm that the Fuller Brush Man knows so well. Now, one of the best illustrations we had of this was a case of a young psychologist who was going to feed her child in this way, and she believed all of it, and she'd been told the baby put itself on a schedule. She wrote down every day when it ate and didn't seem to have any pattern at all. It went on, and it wanted to eat at a different time every day. But she was a well-trained girl, and she'd heard about graphs and things, and she had some graph paper from one of her courses. So she got out a lot of graph paper, and she charted that baby's eating, and then she discovered that the baby thought that the right unit was 36 hours. And it was perfectly regular, but it hadn't realized that 24 hours was the proper unit. Now, you see, that is a combination of our knowledge of primitive people and our knowledge of clinical cases and our detailed studies of child development, in which we then make an invention which makes it possible for us to give each baby a better start than it is if you have a fixed pattern that is extended over all babies, regardless of their individual differences.